Man Against the Grain. How should we think about nature and our own lives in the ruins created by capitalism? I'm Sasha Lilly. Anthropologist Anna Lowenhaupt-Singh will join me to discuss how the Matsutake mushroom, which thrives in forests degraded by commercial logging, helps us understand the precarity of life under capitalism and the possibilities for life beyond it. That's coming right up. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. How should we think about survival on a planet profoundly damaged by capitalism? And how should we think about alternative possibilities when the certainties of the past, particularly the expectation of ever-increased progress, no longer seem to exist? In a remarkable book, anthropologist Anna Lowenhaupt-Singh suggests that some potential answers to those questions can be found in a mushroom which thrives in the wasteland of industrial capitalism. In The Mushroom at the End of the World, on the possibility of life in capitalist ruins, published by Princeton University Press, she traces the interlocking worlds of the Matsutake and those who forage, sell, and consume it. Singh, whose name is spelled T-S-I-N-G, is professor of anthropology at UC Santa Cruz and co-director of Aarhus University Research on the Anthropocene at Aarhus University in Denmark. Her other books include Friction and In the Realm of the Diamond Queen. Anna, could you begin by explaining how the Matsutake manages to thrive in conditions that would seem inhospitable to most plants?
Matsutake is a mushroom that lives together with trees. It winds itself around the roots of the trees, and it gets its carbohydrates. It eats from the sugars that are being produced by the trees, but at the same time, it's pulling nutrients out of the soil, both for itself and for the tree. And Matsutake has some very strong acids in it, like digestive juices that can digest nutrients from kinds of soils where there aren't a lot of organic nutrients around for those trees. So it's a great companion of trees that come in where there's been a volcano or sand dunes or human erosion. It comes in there and it starts processing these nutrients and making them available for the trees. It allows forests to grow where otherwise they might not be able to thrive.
Can you describe for us its appeal for people who will spend a large amount of money to acquire it?
Matsutake is a mushroom that's loved for its smell. I think most of the gourmet foods that we're used to, we think about the taste. But this is a mushroom that everyone who loves it values because of a very distinctive, spicy smell. And once you learn to love this smell, it seems so delicious that just to be in its presence makes people happy. It's also a sign of the season. In Japan, the four seasons are really important, and certain kinds of foods, as well as flowers and colors, are markers of the seasons. And Matsutake is part of the way that people celebrate the autumn season.
In your book, The Mushroom at the End of the World, you talk about the Matsutake as a way of allowing us to understand, to have a window into the precarity of our economic lives and the precarity of non-human beings in the environment. It's a very complex argument, and there are many different levels to it. But how do you feel like this mushroom allows us to get to these crucial questions of life under capitalism in the early 21st century?
Well, maybe a place to start is with our human experience with these wild mushrooms, that anybody who's gone out looking for mushrooms knows it's a challenge. You have to be there at the right time, at the right place. It's not like planting a flower garden where you can expect the flowers to come up if you tend them. You just have to trust that maybe if you keep looking, you'll be there at a time these mushrooms are coming up. And for me, that was an experience that was good to think with about some of the dilemmas that we're up against right now. In the book, I talk about two of them. One is the fact that there's less stable jobs than there used to be, that most of the people I know have precarious job experiences where you're on a job, but you don't depend on it being there for a long term. You have to be ready for the fact it might be there or might not. And that really changes what, you know, this major part of our lives that we devote to working for a living. The other part of it is about the environment, that suddenly we can't take the health of the environment for granted anymore, that the things that industrial capitalism has done to the world has meant that we don't know if the basic conditions of livability, that the water we drink will be clean enough to keep us healthy, or that the air we breathe will be, nourishing to us rather than hurting us. We can't take these for granted anymore. So these kinds of precarities that are part of our experiences right now, it seemed to me that just thinking about them through not just the imagination of the mushroom, but through the actual people who are out there looking for mushrooms, who have their own kinds of precarious lives, was helpful to understand the situation that we're in right now.
Well, let's then turn to talk about the mushroom's history as a way of letting us talk about it in the present. Although you trace the commodity chain of the matsutake from the United States through to Japan and in fact around the world, the matsutake has a history in Japan that is, in a sense, the context in which it then became global. What is that history?
Well, matsutake first shows up in the written record in Japan back in the 8th century, when Japan was just moving into a period of temple building and kind of new kind of civilization. And I start the book actually with a poem that's been found from an 8th century poetry collection. I'm just going to read it. It's only 3 lines. Takamato Ridge, crowded with expanding caps, filling up, thriving, the wonder of autumn aroma. So already in the 8th century, this smell of the mushroom provoked a sense of wonder. And it was associated with this aristocratic civilization that was coming into being, with the possibilities of the palaces and the temples and the centers of civilization. And in fact, with the deforestation that was going on to build those temples and palaces, which created this kind of open pine forest, this degraded forest, if you would, in which matsutake thrives. As Japan moved through different historical periods, that sense of the wonder of autumn aroma followed along during the modernization of Japan in the late 19th and early 20th century. So many forests were cut down for industrial uses that, in fact, matsutake thrived because these degraded forests were exactly where it grew. But then, after World War II, many, many people in Japan moved to the cities for this booming industrial economy that hit Japan after World War II, and they abandoned the countryside, and the forest started to grow up in a different kind of forest. Matsutake became very rare, but still valued. And that's when they started importing it from different places around the world, including Oregon and British Columbia. So North American sources became very important for the Japanese supply of matsutake.
Well, let's talk about the Pacific Northwest. You have gone to Oregon's Cascade region, which is one place where matsutake is foraged. And I wonder if you could talk about that region, its history. It, of course, was the scene of very heated battles between anti-logging activists and logging companies in the 1980s. Take us back a bit further, though. Tell us about this region and how it became, in effect, an ideal place for the growing of matsutake.
Well, one of the stories about it has to do with the first white colonists moving into the region. And they, in the Central Cascades, saw these incredibly grand pine forests that were so open under them that it was like being in a majestic park. And there's pictures even from the early 20th century with people driving their Model T Ford cars in the spaces between these grand pine trees. And they thought it was the best forest to cut down. And it turned out that this area was really important in the formation of forestry policy in the U.S. So the fights that are going on even now between the federal government and white settlers in that area are quite old. The question of who should control the forest, should it be private entrepreneurs or the federal government. And a series of compromises came out where there was some national forest and some private land that passed to timber companies. And they cut down all those pine trees, which it turned out had been there in the first place because Native Americans had a particular kind of burning regime which promoted those wide open spaces and great big ponderosa pines. The Forest Service disallowed burning, and those big ponderosa pines didn't come back, and instead this thick underbrush came back, and it was full of these much more scraggly pines, lodgepole pines. It wasn't nearly as good for logging, but luckily it was good for matsutake mushrooms.
So you were just describing the environmental history, if we were to speak of it so narrowly, of the Cascade region. And then what about the history of the area in terms of the social element?
Maybe I'll start quite recently, where in one of those strange networks of global connections, after the Chernobyl accident in the late 80s, all the mushrooms in Europe were radioactive. And for the first time, commercial mushroom pickers came to the Pacific Northwest looking for mushrooms, originally for the European market, which would have meant morels and porcini and chanterelles. It was in this climate that mushrooms became part of the economy of the Pacific Northwest. And at the very first people to take advantage of this were Japanese Americans who had been sending matsutake to their relatives in Japan. And they started working with some commercial companies because at the same period, matsutake were becoming rare in Japan. Then the white pickers who were being, particularly former loggers and Vietnam veterans, got involved in the matsutake trade. And then finally, in the late 1980s, refugees from Indochina, particularly from Laos and Cambodia, came up to join the mushroom harvest, particularly the matsutake harvest. When I was doing my research, Southeast Asian refugees and their children had become some of the most important mushroom pickers in Oregon and the Pacific Northwest more generally.
And of course, as your book illustrates, and the book in question, I should say, is The Mushroom at the End of the World, and my guest is anthropologist Anna Lohenhap Singh. As one traces the commodity chain of the matsutake around the world, but in this case from the Pacific Northwest to Japan, what you do in the book is also trace all of these many histories that intersect. And of course, the histories of those who are the foragers of the matsutake mushroom in the Pacific Northwest, these people coming from Laos and Cambodia, have particular histories.
So there's many, many different ethnic groups. It's part of what's very exciting about going and joining mushroom pickers. There's Mien, Hmong, Khmer, Lao. Those are probably the main Southeast Asian groups that are there. But it's quite a cosmopolitan scene. The Mien in particular are a minority group today in Thailand, Vietnam, and Laos. And they have came south from China and crossed a lot of borders, continue to cross borders, made it to the U.S. as part of the aftermath of the U.S. wars in Indochina, when they were part of the CIA recruitments of minority peoples in Laos to help fight for the U.S. cause in Indochina. And after the war, when refugee programs in the 1980s were opened in the United States, Mien came with some of the other groups to the United States and became U.S. citizens through refugee programs at that period.
And what kind of effect has the foraging of mushrooms had on these many communities, but let's, take in the Mien, who you're talking about.
Well, the marvelous thing about joining the mushroom hunt is most of the people there want to be there. This is a very precarious livelihood, and yet people don't hate it. It's very different than something like meat processing or some of the other kinds of precarious livelihoods that people need to do today, including Mien. But people there want to be out there mushroom picking, and they see it as a chance to be free from the constraints of the city where they live in crowded apartments. They see it as a chance for men in particular to reconstitute the pleasures of village life that they miss from Southeast Asia. So they create these little camps where there's so much socializing going on. People exchange food, they exchange stories. They can't wait to come back and see the friends who may live in different parts of California. People come all the way from Southern California, Central California, and Northern California to go up there for this mushroom harvest, to see their communities, and to get to live in the forest for 2 months looking for mushrooms.
And yet, of course, if that year the mushroom crop, if one can call it that, is a poor one, then they have taken themselves away from other livelihoods and made quite an investment that comes to naught.
That's right. So there's no wages involved in this sector at all. Everyone stakes their own money, and it's quite expensive. And, you know, you must have a vehicle because you can't walk the far distances. So you need gasoline, you need your vehicle, you need all of your supplies and equipment. And you just have to hope that the prices are good and that the mushrooms are out there. It also takes a huge amount of skill. Let me say, as much as I tried, I couldn't possibly find mushrooms in the same way that the people I followed around. That you're looking for the tiniest crack in the ground, and the mushroom might be several inches under the ground. I was amazed at the mushrooms that people showed me, where I just couldn't see anything on the ground at all, and they'd, you know, create a little hole, and there was this big button under the ground.
So just to be clear then, so you have these many different ethnic groups from Southeast Asia coming to the region to forage mushrooms. Who owns the land?
Most of the land is national forest. And in that part of the Central Cascades, several national forests come together, and you can get a picking permit to work several national forests. So there's quite a large territory that you're allowed to look at. And so almost all of this mushroom hunt that I'm documenting is in national lands.
And to what degree do these different communities go through the process of getting sign-off to go and forage?
Almost all the Southeast Asians get permits, even though it's reasonably expensive to get the permit. But the Southeast Asians, unlike some of the other communities there, think that government has a real role and are supportive of the kinds of regulations that are involved in it. The key community, as you might imagine, that resents the federal government is the white community. So white pickers are much less likely to get permits and register because many of them believe that the federal government shouldn't be there in the first place and that the federal government is just getting in the way of their rights.
So in other words, in tracing the many different histories and places that people are coming from, people have different histories with the state, and
yes,
that informs this.
Almost all the Southeast Asians came from a UN-sponsored refugee camps in Thailand, and many of them were there for more than a decade. So their complaints about the government tend to be more that the government should do more to help people out. If they would like the kind of government that gets involved in the welfare of its citizens, while the white community, while also being incredibly dependent on the government, denies that and pretends that they're living out there entirely through their own efforts.
Who brokers the sale of the matsutake mushrooms that are harvested by these South Asian communities in the Pacific Northwest en route to their ultimate consumption in Japan?
It's a riotous scene. It's quite amazing. The pickers go out individually or in small groups during the day. They go out perhaps at dawn, and they come back in the late afternoon. And in the late afternoon or evening, a set of buying tents opens up by the sides of the highway. They look a little bit like the tents you'd see in a farmer's market. And they just have individual buyers who have a scale and a set of crates. And the buyers sort through the mushrooms, figure out what the price is, and then the buyers sell to the field agents of a kind of another kind of middleman that I call bulkers, because they're the ones buying from all these separate buyers and getting enough mushrooms to then sell to an exporter that then exports to Japan to an importer, where then they go through another series of middlemen. So it's a commodity chain with tons of different middlemen in it, and each one of them responsible to make the mushrooms legible to the buyers, the next piece downstream.
And then ultimately, who buys and cooks and consumes these matsutake mushrooms?
Good matsutake are expensive. So while there's a small amount of low-grade matsutake that goes into supermarkets, into pizza ingredients and things like that, all fine matsutake are gifts. And they're gifts that show that your intent in Japan, that your intent is serious, because you put your resources into a beautiful gift, that you would give a fine matsutake to someone you really respected. For example, one of the grocers who specialized in matsutake explained that a religious convert would buy matsutake for his or her religious leader to show the commitment of a conversion. So it's a sign of important relationship in a family, an attempt to bring an extended family back together. They served matsutake as a way of showing that they really were going to forgive old sins and make a new commitment. So it's a gift to cement relationships.
My name is Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. We'll take a short music break and be back in a moment.
On the oceans and upon our seas, fish full of mercury. Oh, oh, mercy, mercy me. Our things ain't what they used to be. Radiation underground and in the sky, animals and birds who live nearby are alive. Mercy, mercy me. All things and what they used to be. What about this overcrowded land? How much more we use from man? Can't you stand?
My name is Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My guest is anthropologist Anna Lauenhap Singh. Her many books include Friction and In the Realm of the Diamond Queen, and today we're talking about The Mushroom at the End of the World. You can find a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org. In The Mushroom at the End of the World, she considers the commodity chain of the matsutake mushroom, but uses it as a way to understand much larger questions about the precarity of our lives, both economic and environmental. Anna, there are many very large themes that run through the book, and I would like to ask you about some of them now that you've established some basic information about this mushroom. So it's a remarkable mushroom in the sense that it grows in often commercial wastelands in the wake of commercial logging. The matsutake can flourish. And we find ourselves now at a point where, in thinking about the future, we have to contend with damaged landscapes and precarious lives. And you take the matsutake as an entry point to look at survival. You know, what does that actually mean? in the world that we live in now?
Well, let me start with the environmental question, because I think all of us have been alerted to the really dangerous situation that we've created for not just ourselves as individuals, but and not even just our own species, but all of the plants and animals that we like to live with, all of the things we take for granted, the air and the water and the soils and nutrients. We've created a major challenge to livability on Earth. And I don't want to play down the bad news, because I think it's really bad, and nothing we can put our heads in the sand about anymore. On the other hand, we also have to stay alive. And so what this book is about is not so much conveying that bad news, but rather asking about the imaginative challenge. Okay, so let's say we live on a damaged planet. How are we going to get by? And the book tries to tell stories about mushrooms as a way of giving us some kind of a framework in which to think about what staying alive might mean. And the very first lesson for me is that it's never an individual enterprise. There's something in American popular culture where the urge to see survival as fighting off everyone else who comes to attack you. And I'm sure many of you have seen those kind of apocalyptic movies, and it's always the guy with the gun is the one who survives because he kills everybody else. That is such an unrealistic idea about survival. We can't make it without air and water and food. We can't make it not just without other humans, but with all the companion species, all the things that we eat, that we make the oxygen for us in the air. We're going to have to enlist a whole lot of collaborators if we want to stay alive. And so I think the first thing that we have to come to terms with is to try and imagine survival as always a collaborative project that involves other species besides us. And besides our pets and our crops and our livestock also, that truly without plants, we're not going to be able to breathe. So we need to think twice before we chop down all the trees in the world, that we need these landscapes of livability, not just for ourselves, but for all our collaborators in keeping the earth livable. And I think mushrooms, Matsutake mushrooms, really help us see that, help us take that seriously. Here's a organism that can't live without trees, and trees don't do very well without it. That it's that kind of entangled relationship between among organisms that scientists as well as ordinary people are beginning to recognize more and more as the basic needs of our survival. It's not going to be a war in which we can kill everything off and expect to be alive.
But as it seems that, at least around the question of global warming, elites have really abandoned the language of halting global warming, and now it's all shifted towards mitigation, adaptation. Is there any danger that something like the Matsutake could become a representative of something that might actually not appeal to you at all, which is, you know, rather than the need to do something to halt runaway environmental destruction, that there's an assumption that at the end of the day we'll be able to cope because they're organisms that can cope in these damaged landscapes?
Yes, I see what you're saying exactly. And I do think, you know, we're on our way of making a world in which only extremophile bacteria will like it very much. And yes, if we want to give the world to nothing but those bacteria, you know, we're not going to be there. Our descendants are not going to be there. We're doing okay in that case. But if we want anything else, I mean, the thing about Matsutake is they require forests. They're willing to put up with anthropogenic forests that have humans as part of them, but they don't grow in a parking lot. They just can't make it. So it seems to me that we have to use these figures realistically to think how much damage can the earth bear? And actually, what we're doing now, it cannot, probably, if we care about livable landscapes. The kinds of extinction rates that we're seeing right now are so high that only deep in the earth's history have we seen anything like this. So this book is not an intent to say, oh, yes, we can relax. And in fact, you know, the lives of mushroom pickers are quite difficult. While I don't want to forget about the joy in mushroom picking, it's also not a relaxing way to make a living. You can't just sit in your air-conditioned office and, you know, sip drinks.
Well, barring some, you know, great social change, at least for the time being, it seems like humanity and the non-human world as well is going into all of this increasing precarity and increasing environmental destruction under capitalism. You know, that there doesn't seem to be any lurking new social system anytime around the corner. And so then that also poses the question of how to survive all of these things within all of these constraints that are already in place that are, in fact, appear to be doing the damage in the first place. So one of the places that this question comes out in the story that you tell about the Matsutake mushroom is around thinking around questions of the commons, because historically foraging has taken place in common areas, and if they are then enclosed, you know, getting into those common areas. Public land is a commons. I wonder if you could tell us particularly about the case of the Yunnan province in China, where there have been attempts at conservation of the Matsutake that are through a form of privatization.
Yeah, so let me go back to what you were trying to get at about capitalism a moment ago to say an opening place. I see exactly what you're saying, that there's no revolution around the corner, but it does seem to me that we also can't just naturalize business as usual. And so often, every day, we hear that such and such a solution is not realistic. And we should just think about what's really possible, but by which they mean industrial standards as usual. That we're not allowed to think about, well, you know, what about degrowth in certain sectors? What about perhaps certain kinds of things not being private property and open for the kinds of industrial development? But let me move to what you actually asked about Yunnan province. I mean, what's interesting to me about the research I did in China is here's a place where understandings of what's property belonging to individuals, what's property belonging to states, what's not property at all, have just ricocheted back and forth over the last 50 years, that the number of land tenure changes coming out of the central government has been extraordinary. And so it's a place where you can't take it for granted that you know what property is. And international organizations in particular have been trying very hard to regularize property relations in China so that capital from around the world can make use of Chinese conditions. And forests have been part of that story, that forests are hard to privatize because there's so much going on in them. There's not just one resource. There's many, many resources. So the privatization of forests is not a simple thing. Some of the kinds of land reform proposals that are law right now in China have tried to put responsibility for parts of the forest to individual households. And this is an experiment in a way, and it's kind of interesting because it works out in different ways. In the area where Matsutake is being harvested in Yunnan, Matsutake is often the most valuable resource because the forest is not in very good condition or through centuries of peasant use as well as state use. And Matsutake is a really valuable resource. So the question of the management of who has the rights to pick this Matsutake is really important. I think part of my insight into it was that whichever the many kinds of arrangements that people are trying, you can't get rid of this underlying commons. In a way, the Matsutake mushroom itself models this, that you pick the fruit of the Matsutake. That's the part of it. But the body of the Matsutake is underground. It's connecting all these different trees. You don't know how far it extends, how old it is. It's all underground. And in that same sense, there's a kind of underground commons that capitalism always draws on to try and privatize resources, that there's a kind of principle of capitalism that makes property out of all the work that we do in this unacknowledged commons. And that you can just see that in this Yunnan case better than we tend to, because we forget about it in our regular lives here in the U.S.
Anna Singh is my guest. She is the author of The Mushroom at the End of the World, On the Possibility of Life in Capitalist Ruins. That's published by Princeton University Press. She's professor of anthropology at UC Santa Cruz and co-director of the Aarhus University Research on the Anthropocene at Aarhus University in Denmark. My name is Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So the point that you just made about the centrality of the commons for capitalism, the drive that capitalism has to constantly privatize. And so in thinking about, to use the phrase that you use in the title of the book, the possibility of life in capitalist ruins, to what degree is sort of separating those two things key? And, you know, and then what are the constraints if it's not possible to do that in the short term, which I guess is part of the issue here, the urgency of it all?
Yeah, I mean, part of the problem we have is that they're already deeply intertwined, and that the description of capitalism in this book is one in which it's continually pulling private assets out of public arenas, that it takes communities, it takes ecologies, and it salvages this profit out of them that then it claims as the result of private enterprise, but actually is created in all these common spaces. The only thing I can think of as a antidote to that is that as we become aware of those common spaces and how they continue to pervade our lives, they can also be sites for mobilizing allies, sites for thinking about how humans as well as non-humans might be working together across strange boundaries for expanded livability.
One theme that runs through your book and lingers heavily is that of progress and the absence of expectations of progress. So through the 19th century, the 20th century, there was this notion that society was headed in a direction that was ever better, ever bigger. And now we have gotten to a point where the hopes and expectations around progress have seemed to have taken to us to a very dark place. And the analysis and critique of progress as it's been an ideology of capitalism, I think it's a concept that has been extensively critiqued. But you pose the question of what does it mean for those of us who care about justice to also not have this notion looming ahead of us. What kind of effects do you think that has on our sense of the possible in the context of these damaged landscapes, damaged lives under capitalism?
It's a great question and one that was very much on my mind during the whole book process, because I grew up with causes that we imagined as progressive because we thought we could see the way ahead of us. We thought if we only struggled hard enough, social justice would unfold in front of us. And what I think the kinds of questions that have been raised, not by me, but by the world itself, about what this so-called progress turned out to be, which was often environmental disaster as well as social kinds of inequality and ruin, opened the possibility that we had to have a different model of what we were doing when we do politics. And I do think fighting for certain kinds of collaborative landscapes of livability is part of what we're doing, that it might not create one grand future as perhaps progressive movements thought in the past, but that we could still hold on to those elusive commons that we've got that make our lives possible still, both in terms of our communities with other humans and with non-humans as well, as in trying to keep livable places in the world.
So what does that look like then? I mean, are you suggesting that rather than looking ahead, we should be in some sense looking backward?
Not backwards, but around. So rather than just, I think one of the mistakes of progress was this idea that there was only one way forward and that it allowed us to participate in lots of collateral damage, in lots of things that we imagined as collateral damage because we had one goal forward. So everything that fell by the wayside, it just had to go because we had that one way forward. Looking around means paying attention to the other rhythms around us of other human projects. For example, that something like mushroom picking wouldn't have shown up in a straightforward only account of the world today. But it's neither backwards or forwards. It's to the side. It's a new thing, this commercial picking of mushrooms for a livelihood, but it's something that doesn't count in the forward vision. So my sense is that we need to be looking to the side at all the many kinds of times and rhythms around us to see what kinds of mobilizations we could be part of for at least little pockets of expanded equality, justice, and livability.
Well, just to follow up a little more on this one, because I think it's a theme that resonates very powerfully with many of our listeners. How do we think of the future, given the ruins of the past and given the absence of some sort of teleological destination that we're all inevitably headed to, which, you know, not all of the left subscribed to, but certainly parts of the left certainly did. So are you suggesting in some way that we should abandon what might be called utopian hopes, that our future could be in some way profoundly different than the capitalist present or some variation of it?
Not at all. I think assuming that other worlds are possible is absolutely essential. So utopian doesn't mean to me forward striving in quite that way. Utopian means the willingness to consider that what we have right now is unstable, is just one way of doing things. And to me, it's absolutely essential, is the work of the imagination to undo the sense that only one kind of realism is possible. So that needs to be maintained. It seems to me it's an essential ingredient. At the same time, we can't, the kind of automatic solidarity that we hoped that, say, all oppressed people would know how to unite because we were all facing the same way, that we're, I think many people on the left are looking for, okay, that didn't work out. Now, how can we build with the partial solidarities that we have to work for, and also to include a bigger group of people that we might want to organize with, including plants and animals and fungi?
Well, because one thing that I think I could say is that although those in power blithely ignore the consequences of the ecological destruction and social havoc that is wreaked by capitalism, those people who might identify as the left or even, you know, kind of larger group of people beyond that, I think there's a pretty pervasive sense within much of society anyway that things are headed in a direction that is not good. I mean, I think that notion that everything is fine and everything is moving forward in, you know, in a good way, although it's a official ideology in many ways, it's not something that's shared by many or most people. And I would say that's also the case with the environment. There's a deep sense, particularly amongst younger people in this country, but not just younger people, that society is moving in a very bad direction in terms of the environment, that the destruction is very serious, perhaps irreversible. So for them, then the issue isn't so much how can people come to terms with the fact that something needs to be done, but something more difficult, which is, you know, what is the something that needs to be done and how do we make our way through it?
Mm-hmm. I agree with everything you say. And part of the reason I wrote the book is being part of that move myself, of feeling like, well, wait, what happened to this idea that things were going to get better? How do we handle it? But maybe I can give you one illustration, which is better than a lot of generalizations, that one of the political things that was happening up there in the Pacific Northwest was an attempt to create some kind of way that mushroom pickers' voices could be heard. That these are folks, mainly not white, not always having good English, who would not be heard in an American political system very well. And because of the very visionary work of a woman named Beverly Brown, who started something called the Jefferson Center for, I don't know, Democracy or something like that. I got the title wrong. She moved in to non-timber forest product workers, and how might they organize to have a voice, to speak to the Forest Service, that since here's people who would be entirely omitted from the political system as we know it, how might they come together? And one of the key projects was translation. Here's people who not only don't speak English, but don't speak the same language as each other. That a rather amazing project to me was one in which the beginning of it was meetings in which people translated across these many different languages that are represented in the mushroom camps to try and figure out what the political issues were for the mushroom pickers, including, for example, not doing the kind of mechanical finning for fire protection that is ordinary practice for the Forest Service that's been managing for timber. And a small victory was when one Forest Service district agreed not to do that kind of mechanical thinning, which kills the underground bodies of the mushrooms so that they won't come up again, to preserve a few areas that might be a little bit overcrowded from a logging point of view for the mushroomers. To me, that was a very, very small political mobilization, but one that made a difference because of an attempt to work across the many things that divided the mushroom pickers to figure out what counted.
Let me end by asking you a rather difficult question, but as you're talking about the need to perhaps reformulate, you know, who the left or whatever category you'd like to use, who should be included, you know, these people who have been marginalized historically. And then you also mentioned human and non-human. Mm-hmm. And what ways beyond sort of broad platitudes about needing to save the environment, is there some other way that you feel you have come to by going through the story and the foraging and the shipping and, you know, the whole life world of the Matsutake that points to how non-humans can be part of that broader coalition in the words that you used?
Well, maybe you've heard the term Anthropocene used to describe the industrial wasteland we're creating here on Earth. The term, that's a geological term, a proposed geological term, and the epoch that it would supersede is called the Holocene. It lasts a little more than 11,000 years since the last ice age and refers to this period when humans had some agriculture and livestock keeping, but so they were certainly a force on Earth, but they weren't necessarily threatening livability in quite the way we're doing right now. So I'm introducing those terms to say that a program that we all need to be involved in is saving the Holocene, that we can't afford to let those fragments of the Holocene that we still have with us, those places where humans and plants and animals and fungi and bacteria all manage to occupy landscapes together and come up with some kind of co-living ways of getting on, that we can't afford to let those go. So saving Holocene fragments should be a priority for fighting for livability on Earth, it seems to me.
Anna Lohenhaupt-Singh has been my guest. She is the author of The Mushroom at the End of the World, On the Possibility of Life in Capitalist Ruins. It's published by Princeton University Press. She's also the author of In the Realm of the Diamond Queen and Friction. And she teaches anthropology at UC Santa Cruz and is co-director of the Aarhus University Research on the Anthropocene at Aarhus University in Denmark. Thank you so much for being on the program today.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Against the Grain. My name is Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.